Vanishing Prices versus Bella's Voice.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Sean Larson Bright of Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time, please.
Okay.
May it please the Court, the Hoffmans request reversal of the erroneous entry of summary judgment against them. At the crux of this appeal is whether a promissory note for $50,000 that was executed the same day that as the transfer of an unprofitable thrift store business to their nonprofit, whether that note is enforceable. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the issue of consideration.
Well, let me ask some questions. The promissory note is a negotiable instrument, right?
That's true.
So the Uniform Commercial Code controls, correct?
Well, I would say yes and no, Your Honor. As between the initial parties to a promissory note is a simple contract to pay money. So all of the normal rules that apply to holders in due course of negotiable instruments are not really relevant.
Okay, but there's no holder in due course in this situation. We're talking about the original parties to the promissory note,
yes,
right?
Sir. Yes.
Okay, so we have three documents, all of which you signed the same day, July 1st of whatever the year is, right?
Yes.
And the documentation basically was to evidence the sale of the business and assets from one to another, right?
Well, the evidence is that the transaction was essentially a donation of the assets of the
business. I understand your theory if you just go with me here.
Sure,
okay.
Yes.
So those basic facts are really undisputed. So we now have a $50,000 note. There's a default under the note. Article 3 of the code, and I think you have a copy of it, 3117, says essentially that a note may be modified, supplemented, or nullified by a separate agreement between the maker of the note and the promisee if that note is, and I'm paraphrasing here, part of the same transaction giving rise to the agreement. I just paraphrase that. Essentially, your argument here is that the promissory note is inconsistent with what you represent was the basic deal, right?
Yes.
And with specificity, you say that it's inconsistent with some of the terms of the other two documents, the sale agreement and the bill of sale, right?
Yes, as well as the prior oral agreement.
Okay, well, let's separate the oral agreement. So in essence, you're saying that 3117 would support, in general terms, your theory of the case. Is that not correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Now, is there any reason that you can think of why 3117 would not apply to this situation?
No, I think your analysis is absolutely correct, Your Honor, that 3117 does provide a defense to the note, which is one of several defenses to the note that were available to our clients, the appellants.
Okay. Now let me ask you another question. You say that there's no consideration for the execution of the note, right?
Yes.
The transfer of the assets from the seller to the purchaser, why isn't that consideration?
Well, the reason that the transfer of the assets is not consideration is because, as set forth in our papers, there was a pre-existing oral agreement between the parties for a donation of the business.
Let's assume that we don't accept that argument, that there was a pre-existing agreement. Isn't, in fact, at the closing of the sale on July 1st, the transfer of the assets consideration for the delivery of the note?
Well, you're asking if we assume that our arguments are rejected, are they successful? And I think there's two reasons why that's not accurate.
Well, number one, I'm just, you know, first-year contracts, you have something that's given in value for, in this case, the delivery of the note? Why isn't the transfer of the assets? Let's separate out what the price of those assets was.
Yes.
Why isn't the transfer of the assets consideration for the delivery of the note?
Because there was a pre-existing legal obligation to donate the business.
Okay.
And so this goes right into the oral agreement.
Okay.
A pre-existing obligation cannot be consideration. So if there was a pre-existing legal obligation, then there wasn't consideration for the note. So in order to figure out whether there was, we have to go back in time and analyze what happened with the oral agreement. What are the terms of the oral agreement? And what we know is that the terms of the oral agreement are disputed between the parties. We also know that the law is where an oral agreement is disputed, you need to have a trial, because the terms of an oral agreement are the kind of thing where you need credibility determinations of a fact finder to decide what the terms of an oral agreement are. In fact, this court in the Crown Plaza versus Synapse case, which we cite in our papers, had a situation where one party testified that there was an oral agreement, the other party testified there wasn't an oral agreement, and this court reversed summary judgment, holding that disputes about an oral agreement like this are not appropriate to resolve on summary judgment. And here, where in order to determine whether there was consideration for the note, you need to know whether there was a pre-existing obligation, you need to know whether there was an oral agreement, that means summary judgment was inappropriate. Now, the Browns have a couple arguments about why they think consideration is shown here. The principal one being, they say, well, look at the three documents all together, and consistent with Judge Cox's questions, you know, the transfer of the assets pursuant to these other documents can satisfy the requirement of consideration under the note. The problem with that is that if you read the documents together, there's no way to read the business sale agreement and the bill of sale as providing consideration for the note, because both documents unambiguously state that they are a donation, the transaction is a donation, and that the total purchase price, quote-unquote purchase price, is $10, and that is just used in the Brown's own writing as, quote, consideration to validate the donation. The bill of sale itself has a provision to identify whether or not there's a promissory note to pay the rest of the purchase price, and the Browns hand wrote in that there wasn't a promissory note to provide the rest of the purchase price. So there's no reasonable interpretation of those documents as providing consideration.
The record doesn't tell us this, but I assume a lawyer didn't draft these documents.
That is absolutely true, Your Honor. The documents were prepared by the Browns.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Nathaniel Strauss for the respondents. On July 1st, 2014, the parties to this dispute did sign the documents found in the record starting at page 230. These documents included the transfer of the respondents' business to the appellants, as well as the appellant's agreement to pay the respondents $50,000 in the form of an installment note. Appellants took possession of the business and are drawing profits from it, yet they have never paid a penny for the business.
Well, let me ask you some questions, and I think you know what one of them will be.
Right.
Does 3117 control here?
It applies in the sense that it does not preclude the appellant's argument, but they still have to make a factual showing for it and have a compelling argument. This simply says, what Section 117 says is that a contemporaneous agreement can modify the terms of the note. That doesn't mean that it necessarily does. The court still has to go into the inquiry of construing the note and the contract in combination and come up with their explanation coming up with an interpretation of what those mean in combination.
Well, wouldn't that be done by a jury or a fact finder rather than as a matter of law?
It would if there was some genuine dispute of material fact. In this case, there's no genuine dispute of material fact. If you look at the appellant's own evidence and you look at their own testimony, it confirms. You can look at what Ms. Hoffman's and what Ms. Hoffman Nelson's testimony says. We're relying solely on the testimony of the appellant's own witnesses to conclude that necessarily, number one, there was consideration, and number two, that the purchase price of the business was $50,000.
I take it that it is your position that the consideration in this case was the transfer of the business and its assets?
Yes. I mean, there were other other concessions that.
But that's the main part of this deal, right?
That's the main. That's the benefit of the bargain.
There's an argument here that there was no consideration for execution of the note at closing because there was some prior oral agreement. What's your response?
My response to that is that that is that argument is essentially barred by what used to be called the parallel evidence rule, now known as the limits to the context rule by Berg. Berg and the following cases said very explicitly that oral agreements cannot be used, or oral testimony cannot be used to vary the terms of a written agreement. And that's exactly what the appellants are trying to do here.
And what written agreement are you referring to in the context of Berg?
I'm talking about all of the documents that were executed on July 1st.
So you are not limiting the examination of documents just to the promissory note. You're agreeing that we can look at the collateral documents as well.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. This dispute is readily resolved by examining the undisputed evidence of what happened on July 1st, 2014. On that date, according to the appellant's own evidence, respondents told appellants that they would not sign the business sale agreement unless the appellants signed the note. Appellants agreed. That is the essence of consideration. That was the bargain that was made. Now, when it comes to summary judgment and whether this can be resolved at summary judgment versus at trial, petitioners misunderstand the limits of the Berg context rule and what evidence may and may not be properly considered at summary judgment. Now, the context rule does allow the court, even in the case of a lack of any ambiguity, to look at the circumstances of the making of the contract. In this case, the Hoffmans and the Browns all testified to the same thing. On July 1st, when we look at just the relevant evidence, which is that Mr. Brown presented a promissory note and said, you must sign this or we will not sign the business sale agreement. The Hoffmans reluctantly agreed to it because they were afraid, because they knew that if they did not sign the note, they would not get the business. That is consideration. We're talking about the extrinsic evidence relevant. We're talking about the circumstances surrounding the execution of the agreement. It also evidences that the purchase price of the business was $50,000, not $10,000. Because if the purchase price were $10,000, it would completely undermine the benefit of the bargain. It would say that the note was completely invalidated. Now, there is arguably a conflict between the $10 in the business sale agreement and the $50,000 in the promissory note. However, it is patently unreasonable, and no reasonable fact finder would conclude that the purchase price was $10,000 for that reason.
Well, couldn't a fact finder conclude that the version outlined by the appellants is correct, is that they signed this note only because they thought no one was ever going to collect it? Isn't that their theory in part?
Well, that's not exactly the testimony of the appellants. The appellant's testimony is that the respondent said that they wouldn't enforce the note. That's a patently unreasonable expectation, and the Cornerstone case holds that that is not a reasonable expectation as a matter of law. And that case, I submit, was, that case, interestingly, was drafted by you, Judge Becker, and also concurred on by Judge Cox.
You don't expect me to remember everything I've signed, do you?
No, of course I don't. But it's the same principle that holds, which is that when two parties are working out a deal, and one of them says, I will not enforce this note, which is exactly what happened in the Cornerstone v. McLeod case. That is, it is, as a matter of law, it is not reasonable to expect that promise to be enforced. That no party can reasonably rely on a representation that a note will not be enforced and it's just a matter of paperwork.
One of the other arguments in this case is that the assumed name, and I get the parties mixed up, Bella's Voice, to the extent that's a separate entity, is not liable on the note. Do you have something to say about that?
I do. So in that case, the Losh Family LLC case is directly on point here. The principle enunciated in Losh Family LLC is that when an individual signs a contract as the individual's name, DBA the business entity, that both the individual and the business are severally liable, and that there's no distinction between the individual and the entity for the purpose of who's bound by the contract. And that was another case that, strangely enough, that opinion was written by Judge Becker and concurred on by Judge Cox. Strange coincidence there. But that case is directly on point and really indistinguishable. It's simply the same principle. Not only that, but if you go into the reasoning of how Judge Becker came to that conclusion, it says that you have to, even if that were not some kind of a hard and fast rule, if you look at just the reasoning there, you have to look at the business context here. It says that you have to look at the business context. And in this case, Bella's Voice, the principles of Bella's Voice incorporated this nonprofit corporation, Bella's Voice, and then they took over these businesses and they're running it under the name Bella's Voice. The idea that only the individuals signed the note when they signed the Hoffman's DBA Bella's Voice and not Bella's Voice itself doesn't make any sense within the commercial context. Bella's Voice is running this business today and generating profits from it. So in conclusion, we ask that the court affirm.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes remaining, is that right?
That's right, thank you. One of the principal arguments they make is, well, the Hoffmans were threatened that the deal wouldn't be consummated if they didn't sign the note, and so they signed it, and that's enough consideration. And that argument is just totally wrong. The motives of somebody for signing an instrument or a contract have nothing to do with whether there's consideration or not. Otherwise, we would never have a defense of lack of consideration because the response would be, oh, well, but you signed the note and you signed it for some reason, and so that's good enough consideration. The question that has to be asked is whether there was actually legal consideration. And as we argued before, for a number of different reasons, including the pre-existing oral agreement that was in place, there wasn't consideration. The reason that the Hoffmans signed the note is really irrelevant to the question of whether there's consideration or not.
Well, picture yourself going to trial on this. And so I guess the question before the jury is, what is the meaning of what did the parties intend based on these three agreements, three different documents that they signed? And how would you be arguing that to the jury? Because we just heard counsel's argument that actually as a matter of law, that ladies and gentlemen of the jury have absolutely no option except to realize from the context that's being shown here is that the your clients, the Bella's Voice, was told they had to sign the note, and they thought about it, and they did. So obviously they intended to pay the whole $50,000. Well, how would you? What would you do then in front of the jury?
Well, I think again, the reason they may have signed the note is separate from the question of whether there's consideration. And the jury is going to have to decide what were the terms of the oral agreement that had already been reached. If the terms are, as the evidence that we presented shows, the terms were this business is going to be donated. The bargain here is that this incredibly unprofitable thrift store that the Browns were losing thousands of dollars a month on and were facing bankruptcy, is the obligations of that business are being donated to the Hoffmans. The Hoffmans are taking on all the obligations of the business, and that is resolved in the oral agreement. And
do you have anything to say about the DBA issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So the issue on the DBA is, if you look at this, there's two things. One, if you look at the signature block, there's no signature, as was indicated, that the signatures are DBA. There's no signature block at all for the company. All that is identified is in the preliminary recitals on two of the three documents. It says DBA Bella's Voice. On the other one, it just has the individuals. The Losh case and other Washington case law stands for the proposition that, if I could just finish,
sure,
stands for the proposition that descriptive information that follows a signatory's name in a contract is treated as descriptive only and not as changing the character of the signature unless something else in the document affirmatively indicates otherwise. Okay. And there isn't anything like that here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both parties. The court will be at recess.
All rise. Court is in recess.